He was laughing through his pain, telling stories of his youth. In that hospital room that day, George was every bit of his 85 years and dying after a long and courageous battle with cancer. But in spirit, he had traveled back to an earlier, more carefree time, just after World War I. Apparently, he had been quite the practical joker in his youth. He told of tying one end of a rope to his older brother's first car and the other end to a nearby maple tree, and he erupted into wheezing laughter when he described his brother's befuddled look when he was unable to move his car. He told other such stories that day, punctuated by laughter that seemed to be analgesic to his pain. 3 weeks later, memories of George's laughter served to comfort those of us who gathered for his memorial service. People remembered his stories, the creeping smile that would betray his punchlines before their time. But what I remembered most was something else that George said during that hospital visit. We had talked for a good while, and I could see that he was tiring, so I said a prayer with him and was preparing to leave, but he held on to my hand and he said, "Can I be serious with you for a moment?" And I said, "Sure." "Preacher," he said, I've lived a pretty good life and I'm not afraid of dying. I've outlived all my family and most of my friends anyway," he said, "but if I do have regrets, it's for the times when I held back." After a pause, he said, "There were times in my life when I could have made a difference, and I didn't." He told me of his work as a pipe fitter in the Naval Shipyard in Charleston, and of the day when several of his co-workers had harassed and then assaulted a young black co-worker. "I could have intervened," he said. "I should have intervened, but I was scared. And so I held back. I didn't say a word. And to this day, I feel awful about that." He told of another time when his daughter had asked him a question about his faith, and particularly about his unwavering practice of tithing, even his unemployment check. But he had sloughed it off with a little joke rather than treating the question with the care it warranted and bearing witness to his faith. "I missed that opportunity," he said, "because I held back from saying what I really believed, and she never asked me another question about my faith." He told me of another time during his service in the Navy when another sailor made a rude anti-Semitic remark about one of George's friends. "I held back," he said. "I even pretended to laugh when the truth was I was angry. I never said anything. I've never forgiven myself for not speaking up." He was still holding my hand tightly, and he said, "Preacher, I have never hurt anybody intentionally, but I have held back, and I've missed my chances to make a difference." And then he squeezed even more tightly and said, "Don't hold back, you hear? Don't hold back. Holding back ain't never a good thing." Thought of George's counsel so many times across the years. He brought to mind my own silences, my own reticence to get involved, my own acquiescence, my own failures of nerve and lack of courage. And I remembered his words again this week when I read the words that Andrew read for us of God telling the prophet Isaiah, "Shout out and do not hold back," as the prophet brought a powerful message of God's demands to loose the bonds of injustice and let the oppressed go free. I thought of George again when I read Jesus' familiar exhortations about salt and light that Audrey read for us from the Sermon on the Mount. "For if ever there were admonitions against restraint, against holding back, Jesus' words were among the clearest. You are the salt of the earth, Jesus said. You are the light of the world. These words follow right on the heels of the Beatitudes, conveying the message that Jesus' disciples are not only blessed, but are to be a blessing to others. You are salt. You are light. He spoke in the indicative, of course, but there's an implied imperative contained in the modifying phrases here, of the earth, of the world. You are salt, yes, but for the earth, not for yourselves. You are light, but for the whole world, not some closed fellowship. The repeated movement in Matthew's gospel is from grace to expectation. Every act of grace received with gratitude will yield then a desire to serve. Grace always anticipates a response. To be light and salt in the world is to bear God's light and to season the world with God's passion for what is right, through bearing witness and through acts of compassion and justice. We're not expected to call attention to ourselves. After all, too much salt and the dish is ruined. Too much light and people shield their eyes. Rather, we're asked to be bearers of light and salt for the sake of others, for the sake of the cities where we live and our neighbors in need. These days, for the sake of children freezing to death in the Syrian desert, as well as those crying themselves to sleep in our border detention centers. For the sake of those who live without health insurance in this land of plenty, who must choose between medicine and food. For the sake of the victims of racist attacks and homophobic slurs. I can think of no time when the need for salt and light has been any greater than it is in this land, in this world today, than it is in our time. But make no mistake, to choose such an act of witness and faithfulness will require of us courage. It will be like facing down a rising tide. I like the way Tom Long places these words of Jesus in their context and sets a challenge for us. The church that lives according to the vision expressed in the Beatitudes is a colony of the kingdom of heaven, placed in the midst of an alien culture. In a bellicose world, they are peacemakers. In a world that turns its head away from unpleasant sights, they mourn for the homeless, for the refugee, for the lost, for the brokenhearted. But what good is that? The church, for all its vision, is overpowered, outnumbered, and often overlooked. The ordeal of Matthew's church is typical of the experience of the church in many times and places. A small group trying with mixed results to live out an alternative life, set down in the midst of a teeming, fast-changing culture that neither appreciates nor understands them. The hardest part is not being Christian for a day, but being faithful day after day, maintaining confidence in what, for all the world, appears to be a losing cause. In the middle of these concerns, says Tom Long, Jesus provides two astounding images of the church. First, the church is the salt of the earth. The witness of kingdom people seemingly drowned out by the noise of the world works like salt. Though it is only a little bit, it flavors the whole, sometimes in ways that can't be seen. And second, the church is the light of the world. One lamp lifted up on a lampstand can banish the gloom from a whole house. The flickering lights of a hilltop village can be seen from miles around. In other words, what Jesus is saying is that what the people of God do in the world really counts. A pot of soup for hungry people, a missionary physician giving a shot of penicillin or a flu vaccine, a team of Christians working for improved conditions in a refugee camp. A word of tender comfort spoken in the name of Christ. All these deeds of mercy and others like them are works of a church that flavors the world like salt and illumines the world like a candle held high in a cave. Deeds of mercy, compassion, kindness are at the heart of the expression of our Christian faith. They are what we do when we are at our best. But mercy without justice is incomplete. Kindness without advocacy for the poor and powerless is unfinished. Jesus followed his teachings about salt and light with a word about the law and the prophets. "Think not that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets," he said. "I've come not to abolish, but to fulfill." And what does that law require? What do the prophets seek? The answer to both is justice, fairness, equity, a focused concern for those who live without status or wealth or claim. Justice is not a work we can achieve individually. It is only achieved and accomplished together. It is together that we will find our courage. We'll not always be in agreement about how we try to discern where God is moving toward justice in this world. But it is our calling to try. And of this much I am certain. We will discern God's path and serve God's purposes best when we do so in community with one another, open to God's leading spirit. For in the community we find our courage and our strength. Jesus never called his disciples into solitary witness. He called them into a community. Even in his words on salt and light, he echoes such a calling. For all through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus employs the plural form of the second person pronoun. When he says, "You are salt, you are light," he's not speaking individually, he's speaking corporately. It's hard to hear that in translation. Now, in the part of the country where I come from, we have the advantage of a simple way to translate those words accurately. All y'all are the salt of the earth, we would say. All y'all are the light of the world. These are words for a Christian community. The tasks Jesus gives us are ones to which we respond most faithfully when we do so together. But make no mistake, it's hard work. And it's not without ambiguity, and it takes courage. 30 years ago, I was serving a congregation in Charleston, South Carolina, and as part of a research project, was spending several days at the Historical Center in Montreat, reading 100 years worth of session minutes of that congregation back into the 19th century. Some of you have heard me tell this story. For the most part, it turned out to be not much more than a cure for insomnia. But several times in that reading, I found some accounts that, to be honest, startled me. Over the course of the century, that church had faced several clear tests to its faith, several moments when decisions had to be made, whether to flee a changing neighborhood, for example, or to stay and deal faithfully with the changes, whether to help some poor neighbors in a time of need, how to respond during the struggle for civil rights if, of all things, people of color were to come to worship among them. At every juncture, every decision time, that session had made what, in hindsight, anyone would clearly say was the wrong choice. The cumulative effect of those discoveries was, for me, deeply disheartening. I tried to put myself back into their context, tried to understand the forces and emotions and at work in their decisions. And I confess, I'm not altogether sure what kind of different leadership I might have provided had I been there at that time. Reading those minutes was profoundly unsettling. The church had had clear opportunities to be salt, to bear light, but had held back at every turn. And I wondered where their courage was. I wrestled with what to do with my discovery, but decided in time that I needed to share those minutes with the session of the church. The resulting conversation was hard, but ultimately it was gratifying because together we talked about how the church might have been different and more faithful if other decisions had been made. The most helpful effect of that discussion was the humility it infused into all of us. One of the elders put it well. Who knows when we might have to put ourselves on the line like that? Who knows how we'll respond? Who knows if we'll even know that such a moment is at hand, he said. And then he said, I just hope when the time comes, we'll listen more to the Spirit than to our own fears and prejudices. I hope that we'll be courageous and maybe then we can make a difference. Looking at the world around us in this day, at all the officially sanctioned hatred and prejudice and injustice, I would argue that such a time has come, that our voice is needed, and the time is now, and it demands of us courage. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." Remember the grace behind those words, yes, but remember also the explicit expectation within them. And find your courage. And maybe also take to heart the counsel of my old friend George, who said, don't hold back. Don't hold back. You hear? Holding back ain't never a good thing.